This is 1330 WRCA Watertown, Boston, a Beasley Broadcast Group station.
Yes, it is. Yes, we are. Tube Talk. The theme from The Munsters, and you've discovered Tube Talk on your radio dial or streaming on your computer right here on WRCA 1330 AM. We're here each and every Friday night at 10 p.m., the program for the music lover, the vintage radio enthusiast. It all comes together here each and every Friday night. Thanks for tuning in. And, you know, just a random thought here. I don't know why this came up, because it certainly doesn't have anything to do with antique radio, but you know, one of my favorite cartoons when I was a kid, you remember Underdog, and there's a great villain on Underdog, Simon Bar Sinister, and as a kid I was just, you know, he's just the cartoonist did a great job personifying his evil. And you know, this winter especially, you know, I look out the window and all I can think of is, Simon says, go snow. You know, when he had the snow gun and he had that able henchman, Cad. Come with me, Cad. You know, and Cad would say, oh, what if Underdog doesn't like that, boss? I don't know what it was. And, you know, I was trying hard and probably failing miserably at, you know, working Simon into the monologues here on the show. But, anyway, maybe we'll just go with this one, and it will be all over. So it will be safe to come out from the hole. Simon says, turn up your radio.
Right this way, ladies and gentlemen. It's Tyra, the dancing marvel of the age. It's not a dance of the hands or of the feet, but a dance of the midway.
Oh, baby.
Why, she throws discretion to the winds, and her hips, north, east, south, and west. Why, look at those eyes.
Why, the eyes.
Boys, is that hot?
I'm free and easy, my life's my own. I come and go as I choose. Just look me over. I take what I want or refuse. I've got the face of a saint on the level it ain't paid. So beware of these eyes. I'm a devil in disguise. And they call me Sister Honky Tonk. I sing a passionate strain. When I'm low down again, it's fire and it's flame. So be careful of this thing. And they call me Sister Honky Tonk. They call me Sister Honky Tonk. Oh, oh, baby.
What a move, man. What a move.
Oh, do you follow me, boys?
Okay, way ahead of you.
No wise cracks now.
Wrap it up and take it home with you, boy.
Oh. Do I make myself clear, boys?
Yeah, clear. Yeah, right there.
Boys, you know you're only human. Give yourself a break, come on this way. I'm not looking for a true man. All you need's the price, come on and pay. I walk and talk like a queen. Man, that's just what I mean. If you'll buy, I'll sell. It's a loving trip to hell. And they call me Sister Honky Tonk. I've got a scram now. They call me Sister Honky Tonk. Oh, baby. Oh, come up and see me sometime. Oh, they call me Sister Honky Tonk.
The concert was over in Carnegie Hall, and the maestro took bow after bow. He said, my dear friends, I have given my all, and I'm sorry it's all over now. When from the gallery way up high, I rose from my seat with this mournful cry. Oh, 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 Mr. Paganini, please play my rhapsody. And if you cannot play it, won't you sing it? And if you can't sing it, you simply have to swing it, I said swing it, I mean swing it, hope ding dong ding it. Oh, la ta ti, a la ti ta. Mr. Paganini, we breathlessly await your masterful baton, adorn and slay it. We've heard your repertoire, and at that final bar, we greeted you with wild applause. I mean a love and daddy. What a great ovation with your interpretation of a oh, 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 la ta ti, la ti ta. Mr. Paganini, now don't you be a meanie. What have you up your sleeve? Come on and spring it. If you can't spring it, you'll simply have to do that, do that, do not a day, do that, do not a day, did it that, do not a day. Mr. Paganini, you play my little rhapsody.
Well, that was Mae West with They Call Me Sister Honky Tonk, a nifty recording from 1933, followed up by Martha Raye. That was a 1939 recording. Thanks for tuning in to Tube Talk. You have reached the zenith of the fine, independently produced AM program. You've grabbed a glass of Radio Gusto. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be along with our guests shortly. How about another song or two? The lovely Kate Smith.
All by myself at twilight, watching the day depart, and with the fading twilight, happiness fills my heart. When the moon comes over the mountain, of you. Once again we'll stroll near the mountain, through that rose-covered valley we knew. Each day of you.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Ms. Kate Smith. That's a recording from 1941, however, not the first time Kate Smith had done that song. Apparently, that was adapted from a poem she had written as a teenager. When the Moon Comes Over the Mountain would become her radio theme song, and she sang it in her Cameo movie debut in that nifty radio movie, The Big Broadcast of 1932, one of my favorites. We're pleased tonight on Tube Talk to welcome Gary Frost to the program. Gary has been a visiting professor at Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York, and at Auburn University in Alabama. He is an electronic engineer with a doctorate in the history of science and technology from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The name of his book is Early FM Radio, and that's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. He's published a number of articles about the history of wireless, early radio, and electrical engineering, including a few on Canadian inventor Reginald Fessenden. Gary, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
And, you know, our topic tonight, folks, is we're going to spend a little time talking about the often misunderstood, but, you know, in many ways, controversial figure, Edwin Armstrong, who many of our listeners, Gary, are probably familiar with being the FM guy, but you know he also had some other breakthrough inventions and patents issued to him. And you know, it's funny, I was just going down the basement today and I was moving around a few rolled radios and I had a nice little Zenith there and I got the big sticker, the Armstrong FM system. So, you know, FM is, I think, maybe the biggest thing that comes to mind when we talk a little bit about Armstrong, but he was a multifaceted and fascinating character. Maybe you can give us a little idea about the young Armstrong. You know, he was born, as we were talking earlier before the show, at a prime time to get involved in radio. And maybe give us a little idea of the young Armstrong and how he got interested in radio and electronics.
Well, sure. Armstrong was born in 1890, just a few years before Marconi invented wireless, and much of Armstrong's success is attributed to just plain, he was born in a historical period that fit his talents, I think, remarkably well. When he was a teenager, the crystal detector was invented. This was an invention that was amazingly important. You can't exaggerate how important it is, because before the invention of the crystal detector, if you were working with wireless or early radio, you had to have a lot of money. You were either independently wealthy or you were a corporation. Mm-hmm. A crystal detector could be built for just a few dollars, and the invention in 1907 launched the amateur radio movement, mostly by boys. Adolescent boys, the most important amateur radio club that was founded at the time was founded by 11-year-old boys, an organization Armstrong later invented. So a lot of interesting things are happening. Also around this time, the Audion was invented. It was the first electronic amplifier. Until the Audion, there was no amplification, and we might end up talking about the Audion and how it was misunderstood by its inventor, but the important thing for us is that it represented a way of making signals stronger, and nobody had a way of doing that earlier. It led directly to the vacuum tube and ultimately the transistor.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting... you know, it's an interesting time in the world of radio. Last week's guest, we spoke with Dale Boyce, who's up in Wisconsin, and we spent a little bit of time on crystal radio, and in particular, a hunt for one he had been looking for made by Briggs & Stratton. And we spent a little time in that era. And, you know, it's been said of Armstrong, you know, a brilliant engineer. This is from an article from Columbia University on their website. A brilliant engineer, well ahead of his time, Edwin Armstrong fought valiantly all his life to champion the inventions that made modern radio possible. And I guess this quest really started with him when he was working up in his room in you know, that big old house in New York State. And you know, he finished high school, and I guess he went to Columbia for electrical engineering, and he had been doing some work on his own, and maybe we can talk a little bit about his experimentation and successes with regeneration of signals and breakthrough that was.
Yeah, he actually lived in Yonkers when he was doing when he happened upon the amateur radio movement, and there's a large overlap of the people he worked with. When he was an amateur radio operator, the amateur radio operator—it's a community. There's a kind of a brotherhood that still exists today.
Yes, it does.
Among amateur radio operators, and Armstrong his friends he met in the amateur radio operator were enormously important. At the same time, when he enrolled at Columbia University, he was very lucky to have some professors who seemed to have been very supportive of him. They recognized that although he didn't always get the very best grades, and I'm not speaking euphemistically, he was a good student, but not didn't get great grades. But they understood that there was something talented about this young man, and he had a kind of determination, kind of. I often compare to Edison's definition of genius. It's 1% inspiration, 99%.
A lot of perspiration, exactly. Yeah. Yes, sir.
And um, his his invention of regeneration, which he made before he even graduated from Columbia, it was his very first invention. And it also has something in common with his other important inventions, the superheterodyne and FM radio. A lot of people, when they read the patent, they're surprised that it doesn't mention what it was what it's mostly used for today. He saw it as a kind of AM radio detector, which it was. You can use the regenerative receiver when configured in a certain way as a receiver of AM radio and radio telegraph signals as well. But he learned how to do this. Armstrong had a tendency to just kind of try a lot of things. I've been through Armstrong's papers a lot. They're stored at Columbia University. And it's very, what a lot of people don't realize about him, he made a lot of mistakes and nothing would dissuade him. It was just pretty much against his nature to give up on an idea. And even some of his bad ideas, he stuck with him 15, 20 years before he finally gave up on it. Regeneration is a good example of how you could, I know Armstrong sometimes people think that Armstrong didn't believe in theory. He did believe in theory. What he didn't do was develop mathematical theories. He had theories, and he sometimes would go in a certain direction, think he's working on one thing, and then accidentally solve a problem he didn't expect to solve. We don't know how he happened across regeneration. There were some indications that regeneration was a phenomenon that other inventors and electrical engineers in fields outside of wireless were suspecting was there. There was a certain amount of regeneration feedback that was problematic among telephone engineers, for instance. But Armstrong came across regeneration. And, of course, the most important application of regeneration, we're still using it. If you want a relatively clean, the first sine wave, but a wave of any kind, regeneration is the best way to generate that electronically. It's a cheap way of generating relatively clean waves. And indeed, regeneration, a kind of regeneration circuit, is in virtually all radio. It's also used in virtually every computer, although the waves tend to be square waves. I think he had a style that took advantage of a kind of a community he was a member of, mainly amateur radio operators, but also his just own individual determination.
Yep.
He's been described as stubborn, and I agree.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's that dogged determination that, you know, you often find in the inventive mind. And, you know, he was a very practical person from the different things that I read. And, you know, from his point of view, when he was you know, listening back in the early days of wireless, you know, only listening to Morse code, and, you know, it's very faint signals, and you've got to wear headphones, and you need, you know, an antenna and all. You know, from his point of view, he's, how do I make this louder, you know? And so regeneration answers that for him.
Yes, well, it was his first answer, and, of course, the superhead was another answer. You're absolutely right. He often posed questions to himself about the fundamentals of radio. And, of course, again, if we go back to the period of time, they hadn't solved a lot of the basic problems that we take for granted that have been solved. Propagation was a problem. Having an ability to predict where radio waves are going to go once you cause them to leave your antenna.
Yes.
Or tuning was a serious problem, and for some of the earliest wireless inventors, such as Marconi. Now Marconi gets credit for inventing some of the first tuned circuits, but it's very obvious if you read what he writes about it. His grasp of what tuning is a little tenuous compared with what, you know, anybody in the profession would understand. He kind of thought it would be a good idea, but he didn't understand how important it was. So Armstrong is going after, like, some really juicy problems. And static was one, poor propagation, distance was a big deal. So he just had a real gift for being able to zero in on these problems, as a lot of other people did, but the difference is that he came up with an amazing number of solutions for them.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing too is, as we were talking a little earlier, you said, you know, he was a little lucky, and I guess that goes, you know, with the territory with anybody who's an inventor of sorts. And, you know, so he solves the problem of the faint radio signals coming through his headphones with regeneration, but he also, on the other side of the coin, you know, from an oscillation point of view, he invents a transmitter as well. Which, you know, so, I mean, he solves a problem, but he also has a, it's a double hit. You know, he hit that one for a double.
The regeneration was so important as a transmitter. There had been transmitters of continuous waves before. I mean, Reginald Fessin was working on the high-frequency alternator, which was perfected later by a man named Ernst Alexanderson at General Electric. The Poulsen arc was perfected as a generator of continuous waves, although it had a considerable hiss in it. It operated much higher frequencies than the high-frequency alternator. But to use the Audion, and especially when the Audion evolved into the vacuum tube, you could get a pretty clean sine wave out of any kind of radio frequency generator that technologically was feasible during the period. And we basically were using, well, radio stations today are, if they're broadcasting any kind of power at all, they're still using vacuum tube regeneration circuits.
Now, you know, it's interesting, too, because, you know, he gets this reputation. He starts building it even in his younger years. You know, I mean, he was always fascinated with heights, and, you know, I guess as a kid he was up, you know, in the trees, yeah, stringing antennas and whatnot. But, you know, when he graduates, you know, from Columbia, and again, I'm getting this back from this neat little story that I picked up, and it was written by Yanis Savitis. And, you know, he talks about, you know, so Armstrong graduates with a degree in electrical engineering in 1913, and that year he hangs this huge antenna, I guess, between a couple of halls, Havermeyer and Schmemmerhorn. I'm probably murdering the pronunciations. And he's trying to demonstrate to, you know, his professor, this fellow Pupin, if I pronounce his name even close how it should be. And, you know, so he's pulling in signals as far away as Honolulu. He's even amazing the professor, but yet again, people probably were imagining, what is this guy doing, stringing this stuff between the buildings? And it sort of starts to build this aura of, well, this guy has got something going on, you know?
Well, yeah, he did have an obsession with heights. And in fact, the first antenna he built was a 125-feet tall one in his backyard when he was about 20. And the article you're writing about talks about the antennas he built on the Columbia campus, and the reception you're talking about is the demonstration to David Sarnoff later of the president of RCA of the super regenerative detector. And you're right about his he had kind of an obsession with height. That is, he liked to climb antennas, and indeed he committed suicide by jumping off of a tall building. There is that kind of odd connection with height and Armstrong's life.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm sorry. It's just one of those things that you know is part of the hobby too. You know, you talk to people today.
Yeah.
You know, my days of scaling anything are over. But I can remember, you know, when I was rigging shortwave antennas, you know, the neighbors would look at this kid up in the tree, and usually I think the look was, not that I was some kind of a nut, more that, you know, he's going to fall. You know, get the telephone ready. But
I had a similar experience. When I was in the Navy, I used to climb one of our masts once a month and grease our radar antenna. And I look at it right now, and there's no way I would go up such a structure. Yeah, you're right about that. I was going to say, by the way, he also courted his wife by climbing a building. RCA on the top of the corporate headquarters had you'll see the globe sometimes in old RCA movies, and he climbed on top of the actual globe and stood on one foot while a friend down on the ground took pictures, and this apparently impressed his girlfriend so much that she married him, and Sarnoff ordered him off the roof of the RCA building because it was too valuable.
I know the insurance personnel are not going to be too happy with that one. And if I had only known I had to climb tall buildings to get girls, you know, I mean, this could be a totally different program. You know, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about Armstrong. But, you know, so he winds up in the service as well, and he continues this, you know, this thought pattern of improving radio. And, you know, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but one of the things we had talked about is that with regeneration and his use of the Audion, he then begins to, you know, write these explanations and papers as to, you know, why DeForest's Audion actually, you know, the logic behind it all that apparently DeForest missed somewhere along the line and kind of miffs DeForest at the same time.
Yeah, I'd recommend that any of your listeners, if they're able to understand the technical language, that they look up this paper. He started doing research in 1914 when he was still a college student. The Audion, I think people understand, you know, what an amplifier does, but nobody actually understood what its properties were. That is, if you put a certain voltage in, what kind of current are you going to get out of another terminal and so on. It was also unstable. There wasn't a lot of quality control in the background of the manufacturer of the Audion. So if you bought one Audion, two more Audions were the same model, so to speak, there was no guarantee you were going to get the same properties. What Armstrong did, this is another thing that he did where he actually pioneered this. He actually studied very carefully what the properties were based on certain conditions that is mostly voltages and current applied to the three electrodes of the Audion. And through a very careful and meticulous process, he had no oscilloscopes, but he had oscillographs. He was able to just record a series of data points and then plot them and then analyze what was going on. And he actually came up with a pretty good explanation in the context of physics at the time about what was going on in the Audion. And it was a first paper for a student. The fact that it got published at all was remarkable since he was an undergraduate. And it was a really good, important article because there were so many people who didn't quite understand what the Audion was. The Audion seemed to have a mind of its own, and he helped explain some of the properties of it. He got into a little bit of trouble, not too much, but the inventor of the Audion, Lee DeForest, did not like Armstrong's explanation of it. DeForest was considerably older. I believe he was in his mid-30s, and had a doctorate from Yale.
Oh, well, pardon me.
Yeah, and he wrote a response just ridiculing Armstrong's explanation. Lee DeForest, despite his doctorate, had a tendency not to explain the property of the Audion in terms of electrons, but he would liken the charge to little men in boats. It's almost a childish language. It was pretty clear that DeForest did not understand his own invention.
And also
denied that it was an amplifier. He didn't. Armstrong at least knew that. And the Institute of Radio Engineers. I may be wrong about where that was published, but it's easy to find out where it was published. But the panel of reviewers were, I think, polite to Lee DeForest, you know, thanked him for his comments. But it was clear that they should have been immensely impressed by Armstrong's paper. It's a great paper, and again, it's kind of fun to read, and even funny to read if you can follow the technical jargon.
Now, you know, so following this, he winds up in the service, and I'm going to guess here he was in, you know, the Signal Corps, and is stationed in France, and, you know, scores this other idea, you know, which will, you know, again, is a real game changer with the concept of the superheterodyne. And how did he conceive that while he was, you know, overseas in France?
Well, there's some question about that, and I, to be honest, don't think anybody has explained it adequately. I still think the best explanation was by Armstrong biographer from the 1950s, Lawrence Lessing.
Yes.
First of all, there's the concept of the header dining itself. That it was Reginald Fessenden who patented that in 1905. Armstrong, in all of his writings, never mentioned Fessenden's work ever. But Fessenden coined the word. He was a classics professor before he became an electrical engineer. And it involves an old method from the world of music with tuning forks and tuning pianos. If you you know, hit a tuning fork, it'll give you a very clean sound. And if you play the right piano key and it's supposed to be the same frequency, you'll hear just the same frequency. If they're off a little bit, you'll hear a frequency that represents the difference in hertz. It'll be a low pitch sound. And it's a little complicated, and I doubt very strongly if Armstrong envisioned the use of the super heterodyne commercially. I mean, in fact, well, in World War One, nobody was thinking really about broadcasting yet. But there was a problem that was perceived. This is the one I think prompted Armstrong to invent the superhet. There was a problem with the detection of German aircraft, and motors generate electrical noise because of their spark plugs.
Yes.
Or, in fact, any kind of combustion of petrochemical fuels will generate radio frequency waves. The problem is that they're not clean, they're kind of sparky, and they're all over the place on the spectrum, which makes it very difficult to tune them in and detect them. What I think Armstrong was doing was trying to figure out a cheap and efficient way of detecting those sparks as from the German plane. It gets a little complicated here. So had been ways of amplifying extremely weak signals, but it involved sometimes 20 stages of amplification, and that's a very touchy circuit. It's hard to tune. What the superhet does is introduce a way of essentially shifting all the frequencies down to a more or less audible level very inexpensively. It turned out it was never used for that.
Gary, I'm just going to ask you to hold that thought for one moment. I'd just like to press pause here. We're going to remind everyone this is Tube Talk on WRCA Radio, 1330 AM. Our guest is Mr. Gary Frost, and our subject tonight is Edward Armstrong, and back to the superhet. So I was not aware that this was something that was, you know, sort of a military application he was thinking of, and that led to this. So continue. I don't mean to interrupt you.
He was hoping to this is a theory. If anybody thinks they know what actually happened, they're making things up. But I think this is my. I think this is a plausible, and this is what I think happened. If he was able to shift the frequencies down to where they were audible, then it would be possible to detect them a lot more easily. The super heterodyne, the main feature is that it makes building radio receivers a lot simpler and cheaper, and the receivers you make once you get a superhet circuit going, they tend to be a lot more stable too. There's really almost no downside to them. Now, whether he actually got this to work in the war, I don't know. The French government gave him a medal for his work.
Yeah, I'd seen that. Yeah,
and we know he worked on other technologies involving radio communication. The fact is, however, in World War One, radio wasn't quite that important. There was no vacuum tube, no reliable amplifiers. It was nothing like World War II, where it was absolutely crucial. But there were a lot of problems solved in a military context. And Armstrong was apparently, in the opinion of the French government, one of the most important figures.
Yeah.
And I'm not aware that anybody's done. Any historian has actually looked into this very carefully.
Yeah, he was named a Chevalier de Légion d'Honneur, And, yeah, you know, yeah, so, you know, whatever you have to do to get that recognition, I don't know. But, you know, it's an interesting concept. You know, you talk about the developments made during war as, you know, more would be made, revolutionary ones during World War II as well. And you know, radio's application was probably more of a ship-to-ship, very big in the naval side of the equation, but, you know, not so much in the on the land yet. And, you know, just to back up a little bit, you know, you talk about the concept of the superheterodyne and the stability of the circuit, and, you know, as we go back in time here, we go through the crystal sets to the three dialers to the tuned radio frequency sets, you know, and then, you know, the superheads start to show up in the 30s. And then with that superhead concept, I mean, we all, you know, as collectors, you know, take great, you know, relish in finding, you know, highly evolved, high-end Philcos or Zeniths that were top of the line. But what the superhead concept does is it makes the, you know, and some people don't like these, the little plastic midget set that somebody could buy for a quarter down at the corner store. I mean, it would lead to this explosion of production in radio and make it reasonably priced and make it available to so many millions of Americans during a depression, which then leads to the developments in entertainment and to music, and obviously, you know, radio just booms from there. So it's, you know, while it's on one side there's the conceptual end of things, you know, the earthquake that would cause, you know, can't be underestimated, or at least in my humble opinion.
I think you're absolutely right, Paul. The super, and incidentally, the first superhead was designed by Armstrong and his sergeant from his work in Paris, Harry Houck, in 1924. And for about 3 years, RCA kept it to itself, and then they began licensing it out in 1927. Another thing that helped is during the war, the vacuum tube was developed as a secret military technology, mostly a part of Westinghouse and General Electric, and things just came together. The birth of broadcasting on a large scale occurred in 1920. Again, Armstrong is very lucky. He was hired by RCA to design. He and Harry Houck were hired to design the first commercial superhead receiver, and I believe he got paid a few hundred thousand dollars. And this is another, if your listeners are understand the technology, they're going to laugh at how simple the circuit was. I mean, that was the point of the superhead. And he and Harry Houck split on the order of a couple hundred thousand dollars for a winter's work.
Not bad in those days, huh?
Yeah, well, he became very wealthy, a multimillionaire, by the time he was in his early 30s. That was another advantage, and he certainly exploited it. Armstrong is very good about taking advantage of his advantages, I guess.
It was patent income for the most part, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He also became very good at, I think Armstrong would have been a great lawyer. I've read all of his patents and a good amount of the correspondence between him and his patent lawyers, and Armstrong became exceedingly knowledgeable about patent law and how to write patents, which is an art form unto itself, which I say combines the worst aspects of writing from the legal and the engineering professions, but he was good at that. He also was very good at speaking publicly. He understood that there was a public dimension to his career, and I just think the guy was just brilliant at a lot of things, not just electrical engineering.
Yeah, on many different levels. You know, it's interesting. You know, I start these chats, and you know, I watch the clock, and it's amazing. You know, we digress a little bit from the outline, and we're rapidly coming up here to the end of our time. But you know, I just want to throw this out. You know, we haven't even gotten to FM, so this, you know, from a hosting point of view, this is very nice because this leaves a big wide door for us to have a great conversation about FM when we have you back, and we will have you back. But you know, as I'm looking through some different quotes and stories here, and again, this goes back to the fellow from Columbia who wrote this article, I found this amazing quote, and I'm just going to throw this out and see what your thoughts on this are. You know, he says, Armstrong was the victim of a world in which, as Armstrong eloquently put it, men substitute words for realities and then talk about the words. And I just thought about that. And I said, well, you know, about three-quarters of the world's problems are caused by that.
He said that after he lost his patent fight. It was a terribly unfair defeat of Armstrong. He lost a patent fight with Lee Armstrong over regeneration. And he's right about that. The case was ultimately decided by a Supreme Court justice who knew nothing about engineering.
Right.
And in that case, I agree. I don't always agree with that statement, but in that case, certainly he was right.
Well, I guess I tend to think a little bit about politics when I hear that, and it's probably not in the way he meant it. But I've seen it done before.
As we all have. Yeah.
I know. Gary, I just really want to thank you. It's been a fascinating conversation, especially getting out a little bit of the Armstrong early in his life to the audience. If you're kind enough, we'll definitely have you back. We still have to talk about FM. I wanted to get into the Armstrong and Sarnoff discussion because that's something that comes up quite a bit, and I know you have a very interesting perspective on that we'd like to share. So for tonight, we're going to sign off, and we'll certainly have you back. Thanks for being a guest tonight.
Thank you. I had a good time.
Thanks, Gary.
This is the G.I. Jive, man alive. It starts with the bugler blowing reveille over your bed when you arrive. Jack, that's the G.I. Jive. Rootledy-toot, jump in your suit, make a salute. Voot! After you wash and dress, more or less, you go get your breakfast in a beautiful little cafe they call the Mess. Jack, when you convalesce, out of your seat, into the street, make with the feet. If you're a PVT, your duty is to salute the L-I-E-U-T. But if you brush the L-I-E-U-T, the M-P makes you K-P on the Q-T. This is the G.I. Jive, man alive. They give you a private tank that features a little device called Fluid Drive. Jack, after you revive, chunk all your junk back in the trunk, fall on your bunk, clunk. They give you a private tank that features a little device called a fluid drive. Jack, if you still survive, chunk all your junk back in the trunk, fall on your bunk, clunk. Soon you're counting jeeps, but before you count to five, seems you're right back digging that G.I. Jive.
From 1943, that's Johnny Mercer with G.I. Jive. Gary Frost, thank you so very much for the scintillating conversation surrounding Edwin Armstrong. Make sure we get that right. And we can't wait to have Gary back on. What a fascinating and impactful character Armstrong was on our beloved hobby. And as they say down at the secondhand store, how can you wear out gold? Mandolin, Marion Hutton on the vocal, the Glenn Miller Orchestra, that's from a Bluebird disc, 1939.
You'll never know just how much I miss you. You'll never know just how much I And if I tried, I still couldn't hide my love for you. You ought to know, for haven't I told you so? Speak your name in my every prayer. If there is some other way to prove that I love you, I swear I don't know how. You'll never know.
Yeah.
some other way to prove that I love you. I swear I don't know how. You'll never know if you don't know now. You'll never know if you don't know now.
That's Dick Hames. This is Tube Talk, the program for the vintage music lover, the vintage radio enthusiast. This is the place for you. Thanks for listening tonight, gang. We appreciate you listening, tuning in, telling your friends. You can always email us at tubetalk1@gmail.com. Check out tubetalkclassicradioshow.org for a little more information about what we're trying to achieve here. Thanks again for listening. Have a great night.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer.
What a show! What a fight!
Yes, we really hit our target for tonight.
How we sing as we limp through the air. Oh, look below, there's our field over there.
With our full crew aboard and our trust in the Lord, we're coming in on a wing and a prayer.
One of our planes was missing, 2 hours overdue. One of our planes was missing
with all its gallant crew. The radio sets were humming, they waited for a word.
Then a voice broke through the humming, and this is what they heard.
Coming in
on a wing and a prayer.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Show, what a fun. Yes, we really hit our target for tonight.
How we sing as we limp through the air.
Look below, there's our field over there. With our full crew aboard and our trust in the Lord, we're coming in on a wing and a still carry on, coming in.